This is KBOO Portland. You're listening to International Women's Day. Coming up next, Yvonne Guerrero, host of multi-ethnic intergenerational roundtable exploring women's lives and feminism. But before we go to Yvonne and her roundtable, we're going to hear a little bit from Rodizi.
I'm Rodizi. I'm going to do a couple of quick pieces. This first one is actually a collaboration with Fern Capella, who now lives in the Bay. So this is my portion of it. It's a remix of her piece titled Mothers of Revolution. Our lives depend on the strength of our backbone. So mama, stand strong. Don't let them break you under the pressure. I know it's hard trying to hold it all together, feeling like your world is about to collapse, tomorrow's sorrows and yesterday's disappointments in your lap. But they come in anyway. So girl, you gotta fight. This is not black or white. This is survival. Our struggle was prophesied in the Bible. Ever since the first seed, we knew we would bleed just to succeed. Our wombs consumed by consumerism, spiritual aneurysms that are about to bust because we've had enough. So run, mama, run. I see them coming and I'm running with my hand on a gun. The shut up and put out days are done. We gotta resist it, power fisted and boldly enlisted in the entourage of mothers. Those who defy the definition of cultures and colors. We are everywhere all at the same time. The revolution is here and we are on the front line. And we will not stop fighting until we win. No, we will not stop fighting until we win. We will reload and bust back again and again. Not to glorify, justify, nor encourage violence, but we refuse to be used, abused, and silenced. So we will fight from the darkest dawn until the lightest light. 100 miles and running, eyes turned toward the sun. I got one hand on my baby and the other on a gun.
Okay. And thank you for that intro. We're here today in this very, very special day, International Women's Day, celebrating here in KBOO with a 24-hour special to celebrate our ways of being woman, and what all of these means. What does it mean through our different stages, our ages? And therefore, we're here in the studio, a group of women, to talk about our lives, our expectations, and then what we have seen relating to feminism, how we have experienced this, and what we expect, how is it seen by women who have seen part of it but still experiencing some of the struggles, and how is it seen by younger women. Today we have Jade Brew, who's a senior producer here at KBOO.
Right. My name is Jade, and I've been producing some shows here at KBOO, and I've also worked in the corporate world. So I have a lot of input into what my life experiences have been, and what I'm anxious to hear about is the young people today and what they're experiencing, and I can relate back to, has it changed or hasn't it? So I'll pass on to Robinette.
And hi, here's Robinette.
My name is Robinette, and I'm a junior producer. Should I say that? I'm a new producer to KBOO, and also a new feminist. I'm excited to be on this program because this year, or I guess ever since I moved to Portland, I've been thinking a lot about feminism and what that means to me. So I'm really excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Robinette. And we also have Marcela Quintana O'Brien.
Yeah.
With us.
Yeah, this is, my name is Marcela Quintana O'Brien. I'm from Peru, and I got a JD degree in 1993 in law and political science, and I work in the corporate in Lima during the privatization era, and also I work for Deloitte & Touche till 1997. Then I decided, because of Fujimori era, and I had a hard time, I lost my job, I had a hard time to find a job, so I migrate to the wonderland, you know, here. So I end up here and have hard time, start as many immigrants from zero because my English wasn't very good, so I start just cleaning bathrooms and doing kitchen stuff, yes, because my English. So then I went to PCC, and now I'm finishing my master in conflict resolution at Portland State University. So that's me.
Thank you. And this is experience that we see so often, but today we're going to come back to what it means to be a woman and how we have seen these things. So as I said, in this program, we are going to explore and discuss some of those core issues related to feminist theory. And what does it mean to you through those of you who have seen it since this moment of graded activism in the 60s and 70s? And then what were your experiences with those who lived it at the time and how it has helped define what it means to be an independent and autonomous woman in today's society?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I'd like to ask Jade.
Okay. What do you want to ask me?
Well, I wanted to ask you, how was it when you sort of like your first inklings that there was a new way of being a woman that you could, you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but how was it like the first times when we hear that Simone de Beauvoir says that our biology does not need to define us? And that there's the possibility of having real equality with our partners.
You know, that's a really long story because it's a long journey, and I don't think we're even halfway there yet.
Right.
In my experience, in my lifetime, I came up, in the 50s and the 60s, and was a young mother in the 50s when all the women were out in the suburbs raising their families, and I was in the city working, a working wife. You know, I was a single parent first and then married and then a working wife and working in corporate America, and where it was really a struggle for women, a real struggle for women then. We had to do it all. I was kind of looked down upon by my peers because I didn't really choose, it was a necessary thing at the time, to be a working woman
right.
at that time when everyone else was staying home. Mm-hmm. And I was chided by my sister, by my cousins, by friends and family about, you should really be home with your family and
right.
not working. And so you're kind of discriminated against, among your peers, and then you go into the workplace and you are, again, a woman, which is one step below.
Yeah. And discriminated against because you're choosing, again, not only are you a woman, but you also have a family and you have obligations,
right.
which does not permit you to perhaps compete at the same rate and have the same time working for a corporation.
That's true. And the corporation that I worked for, women only went to a certain level. And I achieved that level within about 2.5-3 years of my starting with that company. And what really blew me away was when I found out that the men that worked at the same level job that I did made $5,000 to $7,000 more a year than I did. And it was only because I was a woman that I didn't have equal pay at that time.
And when, what time are we talking about?
We're talking about the 60s. We're talking about the late 50s, early 60s. And that's how it was. And when I went to my boss and we were talking about earning capacity, and
right.
I asked him, I said, why is it that Laird over there is doing the same job that I'm doing over here? And we were discussing salary and he's making so much more. And my boss's answer to me at that time was, well, he has a family to support. And he's the head of the family. And I said, well, what do you think I have? I have, two sons at home.
Right.
And I'm contributing, to their welfare and trying to make our life a lot easier, by working.
Right.
But it didn't matter. It really didn't matter.
And unfortunately, it seems to me that so many years have passed, but it would seem as though we still have not really... have this equity in
it
pay.
Hasn't changed.
No.
It really hasn't changed.
Yeah, I kind of see this too, but I'd like to pass this opinion to
Okay, my mom, she worked for 25 years in the hospital. She was a nurse and she took some management classes, so she and being the supervisor of an emergency room in a very big hospital, Hospital del Empleado. It was a huge hospital in Lima,
right.
very busy hospital. My dad is a surgeon, he's a physician. But my mom, I hardly remember hardly seeing my mom during when I was growing up because she was all busy and she came back home and she was cramped and she has to cook. My grandma used to take care of her many times. So thanks to my grandma, and like my mom had time to work hard, and but still she was kind of she didn't learn how to drive because she was afraid of driving, and my dad always pick her up from the hospital. And she's still doing everything what my dad asked her to do, and follow everything, and make breakfast for him, or everything. And she have to be at 6 o'clock at hospital.
So she had like 2 or 3 jobs.
Oh, right? Oh yeah.
That's the way it is, though, when women work, because your job doesn't end at 5 o'clock when you go home. You go home and it starts all over again. You have family, you have kids that are hungry, you have a husband who wants your time and affection.
Yeah.
You know, you have shopping, you have laundry, you have all of it.
I remember she came back at 7 p.m. and her feet hurt and she was laying on the bed, and then my dad comes at 9 and I said, where's my food? And it's still till now when they come over. My mom has to fix breakfast, everybody, and...
Well, she never broke out of that mold.
She can't. I don't know.
And then your mom was growing up when was this happening?
She was during the 70s.
And the 70s.
She was a nurse, and she became a very important nurse over there.
That was at Lima.
In Lima, Peru.
Okay. So, let's see, and how do you see, what do you think... Robinette, do you think that there's a lot more equality or equity in pay these days here, at least in the U.S.?
I mean, I think we've made some progress forward, but I definitely don't think we're to the point where we can say that there's equity between men and women, especially when it comes to pay.
Right.
I don't have my own family, and I don't work in corporate America, but I know that just working regular coffee shop jobs and things like that we do today, it's definitely existent even on a non-corporate level,
right,
that there's a difference in pay between men and women.
So would you say that even in jobs that are not corporate, you know, like people who do, you know, and this sort of menial jobs are done by college grads, you know, this is what to me is amazing, that this new generation that we're seeing, you know, they're having to confront some of the situations that we have seen in Latin America, you know, where all this great, great abundance and wealth that was present in the country right after the war, when women went back to the traditional women with their apron, cooking and feeding and being loving, et cetera, but away from the workforce.
Yeah.
We're going back again. That wealth is no longer available, and we're seeing people with an education that costed thousands of dollars fighting for this $7 or $8 an hour in a coffee shop. And would you say that we still see that men make more than women?
Oh, definitely. And I would say in addition to even making more at my job, I work in a grocery store.
Yes.
And men's work, it's more than them just making more money, because they do make more money, but they're also, their work is valued more.
Mm-hmm. Why is that, Robinette? Why are they valued more? I mean, you look at like a pretty healthy, strong young woman to me, you know?
Right, and I am. But the difference is that they... You know, that's a good question, and that's what I would love to ask them. But I think that the reason why they are valued more is because women are not supposed to, specifically at the place where I work, women are not supposed to be strong and fit and doing quote unquote physical work.
Right.
So therefore, regardless of how hard I work, regardless of how hard any of the women at this job where I work, it's irregardless, and it's trivialized, because that is not the role that we are put in society. Therefore, we make less, and the work that we do is valued less than what the men do. It's reflected in pay and when we get raises.
When I used to work in Deloitte & Touche as a senior C, working with taxes and privatization contracts, there were a bunch of men around me, and they were always like, why don't you wear a small skirt so you can see your I can see your pretty legs, and then joking, and you can, like, you always have this fear, in Mexico.
In Mexico, it's all the time.
yeah.
You know, even if you're not pretty enough,
you don't
get the job.
You don't get the job.
This is one of those situations where, you know, I think that American women here in the U.S. have made tremendous, tremendous gains in being able to be really taken for who they are professionally instead of how good your legs
if
are.
If you do a research, any report, I finish a report, I'll go to the office of the Mr. Something, and Señor Ramirez, for example, and you go over there with your report, and he wants you to sit next to you, and he wants to see your legs, and he wants, like, it's just very, like, you are trying to be professional and talk about the business. The guy is just kind of, like, touching your arm, and how are you doing? It's very uncomfortable.
It is very uncomfortable. Right. You know, it was like that years and years ago, too. When I was working in corporate America, I worked with mostly a women's organization, and all the people in power were men.
And
they gave you that. They gave you that impression. Mm-hmm. You know, if you showed a little leg and you were a little nice and if you stayed after, you know, the evening meetings and went out and had a cocktail, well, you know, you were favored upon.
Yeah. But if you did something good, because you sleep with him, you know?
Right.
They have these thoughts, you know, it's in the corporate
world. One of the questions that I have is, you know, I have seen I have this theory that the pioneering work that American women did in the 70s and the 80s, now we in Latin America and perhaps even in places like France, you know, this is what really surprises me, you know, that, you know, some of the greatest theoreticians in feminism are coming from France. You know, it is not, you know, still this is an all boys world. But the gains that American women have made in the workplace, in being able to really see when a person is really not respecting you for your professional demeanor and matter, you know, not because of your brains, but because of your body.
Yeah.
You know, I think that in this 20 years, you know, there's been a tremendous know-how that has been developed by American women. How do you see that? I mean, when were you working at Deloitte & Touche, like, for instance, in
my country, I was, like, men always look, you look at him, it was very a harassment situation.
Right, but you couldn't even talk about it.
No, you can't say, because people, you're crazy, you know? People, you're crazy, what are you thinking? It's all your fault, or it's because somebody touched you, you provoke him. You know?
And you're guilty.
Your fault because you were wearing that sexy clothes.
That's
so true. Even women were against you, you know? It's your fault.
Right, but we're seeing something else, you know, that the enforcers of the system, of the male value system, are women. You know, if you get out just a little bit, like if you're brilliant, if you're well-spoken, et cetera, there's always going to be a number of women who do follow all the rules that have been set by men, who are going to criticize you and try to make you behave.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're too crazy. You know, you're endangering the whole system. So I am interested in knowing, was that 10 years ago? Was that
90s.
Just recent
there
5 90s, years ago?
90s. 1995 till 1997.
So we're talking about 10, possibly 12,
15
years.
Yeah, and it's still
years.
Like that over
but
there.
But still like that.
Yeah, you have many congresswomen, but like, she's ugly, fat, and she's a single woman. Yeah, a woman who can find a husband, she has to be
a
something.
Feminist.
Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah, so that's the stereotype that goes with it, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, feminist, ugly, fat, men hatred women.
Well, so can we say that there's still a lot of room for improvement in having equality in the workplace?
Yes,
definitely.
Yes.
Most definitely. You know,
we
the learning experience, I think you really have to stick up for yourself.
Yeah, it's
you know,
hard.
And you have to be proud of who you are. And it's very difficult. It's no different now than it was many, 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 many years ago. Women in America have made a lot of strides, and they're in positions of power, and they've struggled to get into those positions of power. But once they have power, you know, sometimes They change.
Power corrupts.
They change.
It's very
dangerous
when you have power. You can control things.
Right.
Well, I'm interested in listening more about this, but let's see what Robinette's opinion is about this.
Well, I think that we have, I think that in addition to, granted that women in the States have made great strides, but I think one thing that we have done is that, or that women before me have done, is that there's avenues now. There's legal avenues that a woman can take
in this
country, like you were saying, you know, in Lima, you might not have an avenue to voice some sort of discrimination towards you.
Right. Yeah.
But here, I think the greatest achievement of the feminist movement is that now we can say, you know what, this entity or this corporation or this boss or somebody is not treating me with respect and dignity. This is my response to that. And there's a legal way to do that. But I think that there's still a culture of silence. I know in my job, there are a lot of the women there feel like, even though we know we can say something about the way that we're treated, no one ever does. And if we do, we think we'll be reprimanded, or there'll be some sort of penalty attached to speaking our silence. There's always fear and guilt attached to it. But the great thing is that, or the promise is that there is the opportunity to voice, and there is a way to channel that. But the question is, do we or do we not channel it? And I think that that's where we are now.
Right.
Today, what do we need to do to sort of push women to act, to push them to take those avenues and to take on, you know, to use what the women before us have left in place for us to voice our concerns and things like that.
Right, and then to not fear retaliation.
Now, in your job, Ramana, let me ask you this. In your job, if a woman is discriminated against, or she has a beef with another employer, another employee, and she does file a complaint, how is she treated by other people in the business?
Is she isolated?
She's definitely isolated. First of all, you'll be branded as crazy, and that you're interpreting, and that you, in fact, are provoking whatever the situation was. So you automatically become the perpetrator and crazy.
Yeah.
So
you're the victim then. they turn it around.
They completely turned around. You
right.
know, oh, well, and we hear so many times, oh, well, he's just sensitive, or he's having a really bad day. He really didn't mean it. And it's always about what he's feeling.
And it's just excuses. We're talking about he, she. He will never made responsible and to own his own reactions. You know, it's always the woman who has to act in response or be...
She's held accountable for his actions
or for his
wrongdoing, which is pretty ridiculous. So that's usually what happens at my job, which is why women, including myself, which is why we usually do not say... We don't say anything. We're silenced because we don't want... everyone wants to get a raise, so no one says anything.
But in this situation about the culture of silence, I'd like to get back to that later on in the program because I think that it's very, very important to each...
Yes, ESU right now.
To talk about culture of silence. I wanted to ask you, there was one more situation, and it's what happens... Let's talk a little bit about women in power.
Yeah.
And from now on, from then, let's go to the culture of silence, and then how is there equality in the family?
Oh.
But I wanted to hear a little bit about, though, the women.
In my country?
In your country.
Okay. There is, my Lima is a very classicist place. The whiter you are, the more privileged you are. The Indian looking you are, you're Indian, you're Cholo, you... So there is poverty. In my country, Cholo is Indian. That's that right. have a violent relation. Everybody who's an Indian is Cholo. In Peru. Everybody who's Indian, campesino, farmer, Cholo.
It's interesting the use of that word because here
meaning.
It has a completely different
meaning. Yeah, it has a different
meaning. Within the Spanish American context.
So what is the meaning? What is
the meaning? The
meaning
would be, you know, there's, you know, perhaps a kid who is possibly in gangs.
Yeah.
Not well dressed. A low life.
The president, Toledo from Peru, he calls I'm a cholo president because he's Indian.
Right.
I'm the cholo president.
He's reclaiming it.
He claims himself like that. So as President Toledo, is different connotation in South America, in my country.
I just wanted to say too that in the world there's like this sort of movement to reclaim our indigenous roots, you know, or in general our roots. And this is sort of like a cutting edge right now among politicians, etc., as we see sort of diversifying in the in the high ranks of power. But I'm interested in women in power. Do you think, I mean, do the women who had made it in your country, in
Congresswomen,
yes, Congresswomen in politics,
yes,
how does the issue of class play in there?
Yeah. Most of them, they are criollos, like white, like clear skin, with privileged class. They went to private university. They were able to go abroad and have a PhD or master's degree in any in European universities. They're women who had family with that wealth. So they are not represented of peoples.
Right.
You know?
Is our American idea that, the self-made man, is there the self-made woman?
It doesn't sound like there is in Lima. It seems like, you know, you were born with a silver spoon and you keep eating out with that spoon your whole life.
Yeah. So if you have privilege and your parents have money and it's easier.
Right.
Everything
then
is easier for you.
Right. Then you're a citizen of the world. Then you have the law behind you, etc.
Yeah.
But not so for the whole population.
No.
You know,
the poor women are, they're hard workers, many Indians. They have very similitudes with Native Americans, what's going on. Many men are alcoholic, and women are who work hard. They have the little stand selling food, selling clothes in these little markets. There is no birth control. They don't have knowledge about that. They keep having kids, 4 or 5 kids. And they have to raise all by themselves and working very hard and also abused, by everything, all these systems of oppression.
So let me ask, let me ask a question, Jade.
What?
Is there such a thing as the self-made woman in power?
I don't know about that. I haven't seen a lot of self-made women in power.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't. Most of the women that I know that have been in power have come from moneyed backgrounds.
Right.
Educational backgrounds to be desired, by me. I mean, they have gone as far as they can educationally.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen a lot of really poor, people that have struggled mm-hmm. on their way up.
Yeah.
I haven't seen that in my experience. I'm not saying that it's not out there.
Right.
But most of the people that I know that have positions of power that came up through the times that I did also had money.
Right. Therefore, access to law, then access to an education, and then access to the greatest ideals of what it means to be a woman. What do you see, Robinette? What do you think? Is there the possibility, this America is about the idea or still the idea of higher mobility, and that you can really be, you can wish, you can be all you want. Is there, do you see this as a dream, or is this a possibility?
For women?
For a woman, yeah. Is there the self-made woman?
The self-made woman.
I do.
Robinette, are you a self-made woman?
I'm a self-made woman.
All right.
I came up through the ranks. I think Oprah may be a good example of a self-made woman.
Right. Yes.
I think.
Okay. You're right about Oprah. You're right about Oprah. There are people in the media that are self-made women.
I think so.
But
if I'm not mistaken.
I was thinking more on corporate America. Pardon me?
I think it's just deception that can confirm that it's very hard.
That's true.
Yeah.
Okay. And we're getting to that particular moment. It's 12:33 here at the studios of KBOO Portland, 90.7 on your FM dial, community radio at its best.
Mm-hmm.
And we are here continuing with our special program. This is an intergenerational, intercultural discussion on March 8, 2006, 24 hours dedicated to the issues of women celebrating women. We're here at the studio with Jade Brew, a senior producer at KBOO, Robinette Jones, a junior producer at KBOO, and then with Marcela Quintana O'Brien, who
I...
Quintana. I'm sorry.
It's
Quintana
okay. That's
O'Brien.
The reason that... Right. Just put my
feet. Sorry about that.
No, it's okay.
She's doing her master's in conflict resolution, and she is an attorney in her native Peru.
Yes.
So continuing with our conversation, so what do you see, how is the question of equality being, you know, in what means the most to us? Family,
equality.
Relationships, okay. Children, do you want children, not children, okay. Raise children? How do we see this from our perspectives, you know, our stages?
Here in the United States, I'm a Latina married to white American guy from Eugene for 5 years. And I don't want to have children now. I don't know if I want in the future, but in the Latino community here is there's pressure of married women who's, you know, just married for 5 years. When you're going to have kids, you know?
Right.
And it's not something that I'm looking for right now. My husband respects everything and he's fine with it, but it's not like I really have the pressure to be a mom right now. So... But it's in many Latinos, they see it like, are you okay? Are you healthy?
You're 25 and you haven't had a child, it's like, oh, your time is running away. You're a sister.
Yeah.
So, you know, what do you think it's so liberating, you know, and please comment on this, is that here in America, you have a lot more choices.
I love having choices.
Yes, that's true.
When and how you want to have a child.
That's true. Birth control brought that, you know, to the forefront here in this country. And there was a great big change when the birth control pill came into being in the 60s.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There was a big change in women's attitudes, you know, towards sex, towards where their placement in the family became, because they were no longer the woman who had to bear these children, you know, because her partner wanted to have sex.
Right.
And, you know, it really liberated women, I think, more than anything else.
Right.
Birth control really liberated women. And, you know, I think it's really important that we continue to educate women that, you know, they are in charge of who they are.
Yeah, and your options are your choices.
That's true. They are choices. And a lot of people, that the baby boomers especially, I have noticed in my lifetime that a lot of the baby boomers that came up during that time, during the 60s, you know, those young people are childless today by choice.
Right.
You know, they're not in my day. You know, people had a lot of children when I was, you know, coming up having my kids. But then there came a period where, you know, women said, there's something else out there.
Yeah.
Right. You know, and I have the control now to seek my fortune.
Right. And then went on to discover what it was all about, you know, sort of their own mechanism in how to live in the world and not with the predicament of your biology.
I think that, too, it helped a lot of marriages. You know, birth control helped a lot of marriages because I think a lot of people, you know, refused to have sex because they didn't want to have children. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that caused a lot of friction in the family because, you know, sex is a really important part between a man and a woman.
Right.
Yeah. And if you're afraid of pregnancy, you're going to avoid that encounter. And, you know, then when the pill came out, you know, women said, yaha, you know, here we go.
Right.
Yeah, we're here for the ride, too. So.
Right. Although, you know, I used to think, well, you know, so then this is really going to change things. But then I see, you know, kids 15, 16 having babies.
And
to me, it's so interesting because I used to think, well, this happens in Latin America, like in Mexico, happens all the time.
Yeah.
Because
poverty.
But not only that, there's a lot of people who their main
role,
priority or role is to obey their religious beliefs. You know, church.
Yeah.
You know, this is a sin. You know, still considered as a sin by the Catholic Church.
That's
where
true.
In Latin America, a majority of people profess Catholicism.
Oh, so in my country, abortion is totally legal.
Illegal.
All many South American illegal.
And so
awful for women.
Well, you know, I see it coming around that way again. You know, I came up at a time when abortion was illegal, and then it became legal. And now I see they're chipping away at it again. And that's really a frightening thing.
Yeah, it is.
It's very frightening to me because it's like full circle. It's coming around again where we're becoming more conservative and women are going to be...
More oppressed.
Yes, more oppressed because they don't have control over what happens to them.
Yeah.
You know,
right. And then there is things that happen in Mexico still, because in Mexico abortion is illegal, where there's practitioners who perhaps don't even have a medical credential.
Yeah, in Peru.
And women bled or bleed to death.
That's how it was here.
Oh,
that's exactly how
needles,
it was here.
Needing needles.
Right. They so used anything,
like
coat
that.
Hangers, anything.
Yeah. Right. And then there's, you know, and in Mexico, especially among indigenous women,
right.
you know, there's a quote-unquote folk healers.
Yeah,
which
in Peru
again,
too, in Highlands. Yeah.
And where women can die of an infection, you know, there's no...
That's very common.
There's no access to doctors, et cetera. Sometimes these women have children already, have been raising their kids. Many times they are, or there could be... earning at least half of the family's family's income, and then we have the loss of this women. You know, so
true.
One of the things that to me is interesting to see is there's societal changes within the U.S. You know, it seems to me that there was a backlash after tremendous gains by women in this times. Robin, I wanted to ask you about, you know, what is your take on this? Especially because we see that among younger people, there's a lot of people, well, there's a lot of kids who are, you know, in one of the most literate countries.
Yeah.
We have a lot of kids who don't have access to information, or is it all about choices?
I think it's a combination of both or of all those things. I'm worried. Because I also saw that South Dakota just passed the the ban on, if not all, some abortions.
Most
abortions.
Right. Yeah.
And it's really frightening because, you know, it's like you said, it's almost as if we are walking backwards or taking steps in the wrong direction in terms of empowering women.
I think it's kind of religious, because religion is good. It helps you when you feel lonely, when you feel desperate, but also can be very oppressed.
Well, you know, religion is a very personal choice, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that if it's against your religion to have an abortion, you don't have one.
Yeah.
You know, if it's against your religion to not use birth control, you have that choice.
But if you feel this duty as, like, to yes... push somebody else decide because in the name of somebody else higher, you know?
True.
But I think that there's again, you know, the issue of choices. You know, when we're dealing, like, for instance, with a population that is struggling so hard, like in our countries, you know, and you see that women don't have access to medical services or, and therefore, for instance, the pill that would help.
Authorization people. From the parents.
And that's, you know, again, for minors.
Yeah.
And then there's the issue to, you know, we're not talking, when we talk about our countries, we're not talking only about urbanites. We're talking a lot about women who are growing up in the country and therefore who are, you know, whose meager existence depends so much on the woman, you know, and how, you know, in our countries, I think there's, you know, these are the things that they never really get to be spoken about. You know, there is there are the intellectuals talking about it, but in deciding for indigenous people how they
what's
should,
the best for them.
I know what's
the best for you, because they've never been poor, but they know better.
Right.
They
but
study
then,
it.
But then to see, you know, how this dialectic takes place in the first world. To me, it's really, really interesting to see that it would seem like all these learning, all these choices passed in vain, because we have kids, you know, we have girls becoming mothers when they're 16 with a baby, you know, some get married, some don't.
Many of those
here
kids,
in the
unfortunately,
US,
come from very dysfunctional families. Well, what you define by dysfunctional, but there is a sense of loneliness
You're right, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
They feel very lonely.
Absolutely.
And thinking that they're going to have a kid is going to be somebody to love and
be
loved.
Changed, right.
This kid is going to love me.
I don't think that when young people get pregnant that they realize the responsibility,
they
the total picture of having that child.
They're
you know, that
mature.
Because the next 18 years are not yours, they're theirs, you know, and that's how it should be. But you're still a child yourself.
Yeah, but
you know,
they're
so
looking
much living.
For love, and they only
that's
waited.
True.
Many,
that's true.
I used to work as a medical interpreter and legacy and also these translations and mental health with teenagers who were pregnant.
So what did they say?
They said that. It's like the only thing that can love me can be my child. He can hurt me. He or she won't hurt me because I'm his mom.
Right, and then she goes to work like 16 hours a day so she can feed the baby, and then the baby becomes like all angry.
Yeah,
it's
a circle of violence because you don't prepare to be a parent.
That's why I really appreciate programs like Insight, you know, where they will work with young teenagers that, you know, that have no place else to go. And when I was coming up, there wasn't any place like that. If you were pregnant, you were either sent away, you were hidden away, you were taken to the backstreet abortions, you were, you know, looked down upon. It's not that way today. I think that if you have a child out of wedlock, you know, it's just an incident. It's, you know, depending on where you live and what your family values are, I'm sure. But it's not looked upon as being a bad girl, bad boy, whatever, because it takes two, you know, and it's just not us. You know, there's another person involved when there's a pregnancy, but the responsibility does fall on the women once again.
But then the question, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to, I kind of want to throw in some praise for single mothers. And I know because it seemed like maybe we were looking down upon her.
You're right.
The young women who have babies.
Right.
And I'm the product of a single mother. My mother had five kids, and my mother is absolutely phenomenal. I have no idea how she did it. Can we give a round of applause for my mother?
If you're listening out there, this is for you.
You know, you're absolutely right, Robinette, because there are a lot of single parents out there that do a phenomenal job, and it's an impossible job, but you have experienced it yourself. And I have seen a lot of single parents in my day, too, that for one reason or another, you know, ended up being the person that took care of these babies and made sure that they were educated, made sure that they were clothed and fed. And no matter what kind of sacrifices your mom made, you know,
she
did the right
lot.
Thing. Oh, I'm sure she did.
And she probably felt like she was going crazy and needed to visit them sometimes, I'm sure.
Then there was this issue that she loved you.
Oh, definitely.
That's the most important thing.
I was talking about kids who never felt love. Mm. And so, this, I'm not trying to generalize. It's awful. Yes, I'm trying to this kind of specific population who are the product of the cycle of violence, who never leave that cycle.
And I wanted
to
say,
yes.
Right, by the way, that you work closely with what is called intrafamilial violence in Peru, right? What is called here domestic violence?
Yeah.
You work with this population in Peru?
I never worked with domestic violence issues in Peru.
No, because you were more like in the corporate.
Yeah, I was in the corporate world.
So it's okay.
I've been doing a research about domestic violence of immigrant women.
Right.
And it's very hard, and these women finally leave their partners, their abusers, and they have three kids, and it's amazing. They're really amazing women, how they can, like, go ahead and keep fighting and never give up and just raising their kids with all her love. Move on. They move on.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. Having a child does change you. You know, having a child does change you because it changes your focus.
Yeah.
You know, your focus is no longer internal. Your focus is now external on that new life.
Right.
You know, and you want to do the very best you can and give it more than what you had. And, you know, there's all of that in there. And I think even for a 15-year-old that's having a baby, it's changed the focus of her life. She knows now that she has to get an education. She knows now that she's got to provide, buy diapers and buy food. And, you know, it's psychologically, it changes you.
I think that even more than psychologically, you know, I think there is this sort of modes of acting where you could be young but still take on
dependable.
The persona.
Right.
Dependable, mm-hmm. responsible, knowing where things are right. And it doesn't mean, you know, and this is why I didn't really want to talk about ages, because it encloses, it encases us.
Yes,
I think that there can be young people who are tremendously responsible and loving and know what it means to be a good parent.
Yeah.
And then there's people who could have who could be 60 and still
careless
completely. Yeah. You know, irresponsible.
So it's very there is you can't generalize things.
Right.
It's very I'm talking about people who is mentally you know, how like issues. I don't know if I can make myself clear. It's different for different.
It's different, and then
each
this
case is specific,
right? And this is again the sort of choices that we have. You know, like as we mentioned, you know, your age does not really determine you. And for instance, what I wanted to say is that even having all this tremendous activism that happened here in the United States in the 60s and the 70s, in the 80s, although there were there's pills and everything, or there's the pill and everything.
Right.
It's still ultimately, it's your own choice.
Yeah.
You know, you choose how you want your life, you know, and you get to choose too whether, you know, you're here to, you know, you're going to make money, you're going to change your stage in life.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or like many of us have done, you know, we chose to have children and raise the children and improve our lives and go to school all at once, you know, and how
it's
do we
hard.
Do it?
No, it's very hard. It's very, very difficult. You know, I was raising my kids, working a full-time job. I was taking night classes, trying to be involved in PTA and Cub Scouts and do whatever it took to let my children know I loved them.
Right.
And I was away from them, but it didn't mean that I didn't love them or wasn't interested or caring about what they did. And I'm sure your mother, Robinette, did the same thing.
Definitely.
You know, and it's just that little tiny bit that you have to give of yourself, you know, to your mother had five. I can't imagine that. I just can't imagine that.
I know she's a rock star.
These immigrant women didn't have choices.
That's amazing. You know, I wanted to ask Robinette a question now, you know, because in your lifetime, you've had birth control. I mean, you know, that's been accepted, and you know, abortion has, you know, been okay. What would happen to you now if birth control was not available? I mean, talk about your peers. I'm not talking about you individually.
Oh, okay.
You know, like if none of these services were available, what would happen to young people today? Would they rebel?
I can't speak for, you know, everyone out there, but I have to say that. You know, the time I was, it's really, really scary.
It is scary.
Because, like, when you're in a country where you're penalized for having, you know, for keeping your own boundaries, for having your will, be your will about your body, your life, your energies, your future. You know, I don't think there's anything sadder than, you know, being the unwilling mother of another human being. You know, there's research that says that our bodies are made not only of flesh and bone, but also of every emotion that the mother is feeling during the gestation process.
Right.
And there's unfortunately people who were not, you know, women who felt invaded by an unwanted pregnancy.
Yeah.
And we have people who have documented mental illnesses and who can never really make contact with other human beings as a result of violence.
I just going back to my research of these immigrant women, Latinas, they didn't choose to have four kids. Many times, you know, these women didn't have the choice, and they became mothers.
I think we can take
in what they told me. Oh, there's so okay.
I'm sorry. Yes. So one of the things that I wanted to say in closing with the issue of the, you know, our mothers who saw all these things, who had the choice of getting, you know, living in partnership or not living in partnership, being married or not, you know, I do want to say that there's a very, very important thing happening for women, not only in the States, but also in Mexico, and I don't know if this is in Lima as well, where women are having children who they desire, children who they love, carrying their children of feeding their children, and where there is, I think, a substantial change in which it doesn't matter, you know, like having a child out of wedlock is not, you know, it's not so, you know, there's not so much of the censorship of women having children when they're unattached. So have you seen, I mean, there used to be the question of the, like in Mexico, if you are not married, if you did not have the bounds of marriage and you had a child, then your son was a bastard.
Yeah.
Well,
it's still so, in Lima. This kind of, prejudice,
yeah.
Yeah, exists, like, if you're single. And I don't know here.
I don't know. I've seen it go both ways, you know. Yeah. When I was coming up, when I was younger, you know, it was frowned upon. But I've seen that attitude change. I've seen that attitude change a lot in my lifetime in this country, where, you know, women, you know, single parents, single women, you know, don't necessarily have to have a partner. And many times I think it's a good thing, because maybe her partner is abusive or whatever.
Yeah.
But I think having a child, you know, is a personal choice, whether you have a partner or not. It's mm-hmm. a responsibility that you take on as a human being,
right,
you know, to raise another.
Because it's for your whole life, you know. It's
it is
not
your
just,
whole life. It's yes. not just for now until they're six and they go to school. It's forever. It's
right.
forever.
It's forever. And so much of who you are is
That's
going
true.
To be manifested in that next generation.
Right. When divorce was looked down upon in my day. My mom was a single parent, you know, and I was raised, you know, in a matriarchal society. You know, the women were the strong ones.
Right.
And because there weren't any men around, you know, they all deserted. So... You know, they all took off, and so here are these women, you know, left raising these children, and
I really like what you're mentioning right now. I wish we can come back, but I'd like to ask Robinette, what are your perspectives on this, you know, getting, you know, being attached or not, and having children?
Well, I think that one of the characteristics of my generation, or my friends specifically, is that we're very mobile and we move a lot. So it scares me to think, going back to your question, Jade, about if we did not have the option to use contraceptives,
yes.
what would happen? And I think that...
Sorry for a little bit of music.
I think that one of the... It would have a tremendous impact on how the choices that we made as far as school is concerned, because my generation, I know that we all tend to leave home to go to school, and this is talking about folks, you know, young people in the States or whatever. We grow up, we go to college in another state, and then we get a job sometimes that's not in the state where we are, at least most of my friends do. So thinking about them now, and if they didn't have the choice to be on the pill or whatever, you know, I would either have a lot of god nieces and god nephews or a lot of friends who are still virgins, is what I think. So thank God for
the pill.
The pill.
And other things.
Amongst other things.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, Jane, do you think that you mentioned that your mom was sort of a matriarch? You know, which I'm assuming a very strong woman, and then all the men deserted and everything. This seems to be like a continuous sort of theme among women who finally decide for their own, you know, where you don't need to have, I mean, it's all about choices. But do you think that having a mom, strong mom like yours, actually define who you are as a woman?
Well, actually, my mom was not a strong woman. My mother was an alcoholic, and she was an abusive parent. But she did teach me that the only helping hand you have is at the end of your arm, and that you better learn to take care of yourself in a healthy manner. You know, she had a lot of problems, and I learned by living with her and seeing what she had to deal with. And I didn't understand it. You know, I was an acted out teenager. You know, I was kind of a wild kid, and because I didn't have any direction. But so my mother, it was a matriarchal society. You know, I mean, I had grandparents, I had aunts, and I had loving people in my family. But my mom, she was very strong because she had to take care of my sister and myself. But she had a lot of severe problems herself. And I think observing my mom made me stronger,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I knew that I wasn't going to fall into the same pit that my mother fell into
right.
at such an early age, you
right.
know. And
was your mother very young when she had you?
She was in her 20s. She was young. She was young. And, you know, but my mother came up through the Depression, and she was an alcoholic her whole life. And the last 10 years of her life, and I was her caregiver. And when, before she died, you know, I asked her, I said, Mom, I said, you know, why did alcohol take over your life when you were such mm-hmm. a young person? And she said that to her that life was a big disappointment. She had expected a lot more out of marriage and
right.
out of life. And the Depression was a very, very difficult time for a lot of people.
Yes.
You know, and
it continues to be so, you know, I don't mean to compare, but, you know, in the world, there's a lot of
right.
people, again, suffering because of poverty. You
right.
know, because
but she was a strong woman, you know, even though she was an alcoholic. She went to work every single day. You know,
right.
she worked every day, and she never missed work, and there was always, you know, food on the table, and we always had a birthday.
Yes.
And, you know, the things of that nature, so.
So we're here on the special program on an intergenerational, intercultural discussion. Thank you. It's 1 o'clock here at the studios of KBOO in Portland, Oregon. 90.7 FM in your dial if you're listening here mm-hmm. in Portland, Oregon. Otherwise, hello there. And the Internet, wherever you're listening to, you can only listen to this type of discussion here at KBOO. Continuing with our conversation with Jade Brew, a senior producer here at KBOO, Robinette Jones, a producer here, a junior producer at KBOO, and then Marcela Quintana O'Brien, Masters in Conflict Resolution, and former attorney in her native Lima, Peru. Your host is Yvonne Rivero. So we were talking a lot earlier about some of the experiences that women have in taking their lives into their hands and fleeing away from oppression as is seen in domestic relationships, marriages, and then saving your kids from oppression. And this is part of, or oppression by those who we love, which happens sometimes in marriages, partnerships, etc. Could you tell us a little bit about what you're doing, the work that you're doing with immigrant families, Marcela?
Oh, I don't know if I feel good. I'm researching them. I try to understand how social service can be more effective, more cultural sensitive towards Latinas' needs, in these cases of domestic violence. So I'm interviewing 6 survivors, wonderful women, and they tell me their stories, how they migrate here, how they made their ex-partners here, and all their suffering and all, jumping through the
hoops. Yes.
In order to get help and afraid of no asking for help because of document issues or afraid of losing their kids. All this, what struggle the most is these women will never ask for help again because they're afraid that their kids born here, but they are undocumented. So these women are very afraid of losing their kids. Yes.
So what happens
taking
to
out
them?
Their kids. They're living, they're making ends meet, and they're have some kind of stamps because their kids born here, but they don't want to call the police anymore or stuff like that because they're undocumented and say they're going to take away their kids.
Well, what happens to an undocumented person when they file a complaint with that kind of domestic violence?
Usually they don't ask about the legal issues. They're more concerned about safety. So they go to shelters and they can help, and they have kids who are U.S.-born kids. So that can help, but these women refuse to ask for help now.
Well, but because they're assuming that we, you know, that there's still those laws, like they were in California,
yeah.
where anyone who was in social services
yeah.
had the prerogative, or, you know, and right now there's this other law, the Sensenbrenner Brother Bill,
yeah,
that would mandate that if you are a social worker, you have, you know, you will be a criminal if you do not report this type of things, you know. And then we have kids who are who are U.S. citizens, you know.
And these women are so feared because they're the biggest fear is losing their kids because they're going to be deported and the kids will stay here.
That's what I was wondering about.
You know. That's the reason that they just try to ask the fixing and in their community or asking for help, but they don't trust.
Well, what does it take to deport a person? I mean, what does it?
You just go, I think, to migrations and just tell the double check a social security number that is fake. So, there is your visa or your passport. So they don't have those documents. So
and then
they're migrant workers. They used to work in Hillsboro. They are still working in Taco Bell. And
so when people find out that they're undocumented,
they have to move to another place asking for using their fake social security number and asking for another place.
So
to
they
work.
Just move on.
They just move on around this town and try. And
that's really sad.
Or working under the table cleaning houses.
Right.
What to me is really sad is that many times it is the male. You know, the male may be even a citizen who will never grant, even residency to the woman.
Three of the women, they're permanent residents, and they don't ask.
By not marrying them?
They don't marry
them.
Or
by never
fix their papers.
Children, right?
They don't fix their papers, or they don't recognize their children.
Because again, you know, there's this issue of control.
That would be a very scary thing, a very scary position to be in as a woman. Being an immigrant woman.
Two of them that their ex-partners put in through immigration and deported them. And thanks to legal aid, some kind of... There is a law
and
about...
And the children remain with him and...
She recovered her kid and finally, but she's asking for asylum. Because life-threatening.
Right.
You know, so they get the chica.
I can see why women keep their mouths shut, you know, because they're afraid of many things.
Yeah.
Women.
Right. So it's an easy target.
What to me is sad is to see that this is happening, you know, in happening so many times. You know, these are not just isolated cases.
Yeah.
But happens with more frequency than you would imagine. But again, you know, you need to be sort of knowing about these things because people don't talk. You know, there is this rule of silence,
right?
Yeah.
that was mentioned before, and I think that again, you know, the ability to speak up, to say, and to have the courage to talk about
but
this.
But they're
things.
Afraid of losing their kids. They may
of course.
A mother no,
of course.
Be separated of their own children. So it's, it can be worse.
You go through anything, you know, to keep your family intact, you know, and suffer any kind of abuse to keep your family intact.
And then they say yes,
right.
Holding it.
Well, I'd like to ask you all the present here about. When we talk about feminism and we talk about, you know, the right for a woman to have equality in the workplace, to be regarded in your family as an equal, to be regarded by your children as an equal person, to make the same money that men are making, to have equality in your one-to-one relationships, mm-hmm. and then to have equality in front of the law. How do we see this, each one of you, how do we see this as, you know, as a dream, as something that is being accomplished? Do you see a backlash? Where are we? Where, you know, how, if we are working in theory and we are, you know, and we are those who, you know, are living under this philosophy, where are we? Where are we as people?
Hmm.
Is it too broad?
I think the most important thing in life is to have someone who's fair, you know, I'll start with personal relationships.
Yes.
I think that in a personal relationship, having someone who's a fair-minded person,
right,
who understands your place and you understand their place is what's really important in a relationship. I think being fair is so elementary.
Yeah.
You know, to have fairness, be fair with the financial responsibility, be fair with the menial tasks that it takes, you
right.
know, be fair with the children, you know, with the taking care of the children. I think fairness is a very simple word and a very simple place to start, but I want someone who's fair.
Awareness. I think people, they think I'm fair, but many men, they don't.
They don't know what fair is.
So I say, I'm being fair. I'm, you know.
Because you get to do the dishes, so, and he gets to sit down in front of the TV, right?
Yeah.
Every time my husband is a wonderful person.
He's very open. He's wonderful. He really understands.
I had a very fair partner, too, who was fair in every sense of the word, and I never thought late in life that I would find someone that was my age but that was fair.
Right.
You know, but I did. So keep looking out there, ladies. He's out there.
just to let you know, my American side family, the O'Brien's family, we was Mother's Day last year, and we end going to my sister-in-law's house with her husband. It was my mother-in-law, my father-in-law, and my husband. We were all together. And they decided to watch golf on the TV, and my mother-in-law and my sister-in-law, they all, like, cooking like a crazy, running around, taking care of my nieces and nephews, and my husband took helping over there. And they took, and there was, the dinner was beautiful, and the table was set up. But my father-in-law and my brother-in-law just watching the stupid golf game, and then, let's celebrate, here's the wine, you know, Mother's Day. They were, didn't realize how rude they were with them, that they made that beautiful dinner for themselves to celebrate the Mother's Day. And they were like, and they're wonderful people, they're nice people, but sometimes they're not aware.
It is unawareness, male privilege. Because someone has to do, cook the meal, someone has to prepare it, someone has to serve it.
They didn't do anything, and they didn't even bother to cheer out with them and says, you know, Happy Mother's Day. They didn't even buy the wine. They were just watching the TV and getting.
So I want to ask Jay. Before we go to Robin, I want to ask you a question.
What?
You said that a man your age who was really, you know, who had really, really sort of this values that are important to us as feminists.
Right.
Yeah. You think that this was almost an impossibility?
Well, you know, from a lot of the men in my age group, I'd say yes, you know. And then I met Don, and who was totally, totally different. And it was like having my best friend, you know, as my lover and as my partner.
That's what I found my husband, too.
And, you know, because he liked to do all of the things that, you know, pleased me. And
so
he was very fair. He was very fair in every sense of the word. In every sense of the word, we found our niche. We found our jobs, which we were both better at, and we both, you know, did them. We worked together as partners in many business ventures.
Right.
And
even in business.
In business, we had a lot of jobs that we took that were together jobs. And
You have how many years from broadcasting?
Well, I worked in broadcasting in the 80s for ABC, and then when I came out here, I volunteered at KABU. But
how interesting.
And Don was an entertainer. My partner was an entertainer, so he also, you know, was in this business, and we had a lot of things in common, which is real important. But he was fair, girls, fair. Look for someone who's fair. F-A-I-R, fair.
I think men needs to be aware, and they're wonderful men, and they're rude. You know, they do things like you're not aware of those things. You know, that she's doing all the work and trying to please you.
But is
this because society tells you that this is the way it's supposed to be, or is this a choice that they have to make, that the man has to make?
The choice.
I don't know. Let's see.
She's laughing over there, Robinette. What are you laughing at? What are you laughing at, Robinette?
Oh, I just...
It's just impossible.
Have you found that fair person yet?
Oh, I haven't found my Don yet.
You haven't?
Not yet, but I'm looking for fair and balanced. It's just the word fair.
It is. It's a simple word, you know, and when I first met him, you know, and I kind of... He came with a jaded background, and I thought, well, you know... I was making a list of all the things that were important in a partner, and fair was the first thing that came to my mind. And
To listen. I love my husband. He really listens.
Yes, that's you know that's being fair.
Enjoys listening. So
and
the dishes too.
Yeah, he does at least.
Right.
Okay. Now let's see. So Let's come back and let me ask you, in each one of your stages, your ages, your life experience, your aspirations, what would you like to see happen in your lifetime from the perspective of being a woman? Robinette.
What would I like to see happen for women as a whole?
For women as a whole, you know, in the next, I don't know, in your lifetime.
In my lifetime.
Yes.
I would love to see a critical feminist definition of fair.
That's a great word, Robinette.
I would love for everyone to know what fair means, and not the Fox definition of fair.
Right.
I'm talking a feminist definition of fair. I would love to see that. But what I would really love to see in addition to that is I would like to see more women my age take on this role of feminism and embrace it and adopt some of its core values and what it means. And specifically, I'm talking now to women of color and young women, because for a long time there was some apprehension to sort of jumping on board with the feminist movement. But I think that folks like Margaret Cho and the bell hooks and myself and all these other sort of women, we can really all come together and shape a new feminist movement and really include some things like what is fair and what is listening and what are these roles and you know, how we are going to, you know.
Right. There's, you know, I wanted to say here that I've heard, you know, not only in Mexico but here, you know, this sort of the assumption that if you're a woman who's a feminist, then you are absolutely mad with men, hate men, a male hater.
In Philippines, I talked to a graduate student. She's a Chicana, and she said, I'm all for the rights of women, but I'm not feminist. You know?
Why did she say that, do you think?
I think it's at this connotation of men hatred and traditional and women, you know?
Feminism and lesbianism, you know, those.
But there's nothing wrong to be a lesbian, too.
No, there isn't.
But there's always this idea.
It's not, you know?
There's this idea, you know, what to me was, you know, so interesting. You know, like, I have been interviewing a poet, Oscar Wong in Mexico, whose poetry I was translating. Yeah. And then all of a sudden came the issue of this feminist historian.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, yeah, she's really, really, Rianne, what's her name? The one who discovered the goddess.
Yeah, maybe it's the Marianism, that kind of values that good women should be a good mother, good support for the family and help the husband and help.
Right, but that's where machismo comes from.
So, but that's what they are so internalized, that they are. If you're not like that, you're a bad woman and feminist with bad and hatred and.
I think that a lot of people were afraid of the word feminist. I think that a lot of people associated feminist with anger.
Yes.
You know, and it's very true, because I think a lot of women in my generation were angry.
And it's good to be angry.
They were angry, so what's wrong with that?
It's awareness. Okay. Be aware of things.
I want to ask Robinette, do you feel in this generation, is this connotation of anger in feminism? If you're a feminist, do you have to be angry?
No.
Well, no, but there is stereotypes attached to feminism, and it's more than just being angry. Because when black people stood up, when the Black Panther Party sort of, even before the Black Panther Party, when black folks started when the civil rights movement started, the first thing people said, oh my God, these black people are angry. People are angry. People should be angry.
I
am angry sometimes. It's an emotion that we all feel and have experience with. But what happens is, you know, people try to trivialize and sort of demonize you and what you are trying to work for by saying, oh, you're angry. I'm happy to say that I'm angry sometimes, just like I am loving sometimes as well. All of these emotions are housed within us. But in addition to that, feminism is also, it's also seen as, you know, for many, many years, I was also that person who said, you know, I'm not a feminist. Do not say I'm a feminist. I'm a humanist. I'm black. I'm a woman, first and foremost, and all these other sorts of things. And that's because feminism was sort of introduced as this white woman, this Western idea of what the new woman or what women should be.
Right.
So it's more than just being angry. It was like the angry white lesbian.
Right.
For many, many years. But, you know, once you have a critical discussion, you know, throughout time, we have this critical discussion, and we have people like Margaret Cho, and we have people like Bell Hooks who are saying,
right,
no, and Angela Davis, and I can keep going and going. And these women are saying, you know what? Feminism is more than just that. And, you know, if there's some room here, we can all jump on board.
Right.
So it's more than just being angry. It's also about, and it's okay if we're angry.
I want to add to this that also in the Chicana movement, Sheree Moraga, Ana Castillo, many other writers are, again, you know, looking at what is feminism outside of this model.
Yeah, and it's good. Anger, long as it's an energy. I saw it as an energy that can do good things.
That's true.
Not only bad things.
True.
It's the flame that keeps you alive and be you aware. And what I wish for women in the next... feminist is women still having fears.
You know, fears.
No fears. In any reason.
Fears.
Yeah.
Being,
you know, something Robinette said.
No fears. Fears of scare.
Oh.
I don't want women be scared to give an opinion, be scared or say something that bothers you or call if follow you are crazy, you know, or something like that. This kind of, maybe I shouldn't say that. Maybe I was misunderstanding. That kind of internalized thing that really disturb in your work.
Right. You would like to see women move away from their fears, challenge their fears, still speak up.
Speak up, speak up and no big labels, Chrissy.
That's true, no big labels. And I like what Robinette said, too, when she said, I'm not a feminist, I'm a humanist.
Yeah.
That's the truth. We are humanists. And I would like to see more women in places of power, in leaders, because I think we have a different outlook as to how we solve problems as a woman. Right. We're multitaskers. We look at the big picture. We just don't, most of the women that I know do not have tunnel vision. You know, we're looking at it all.
Right.
You know, we look at the big picture. And I think it takes somebody like that to lead us. I want to see women leaders. That's what I want before I croak.
Right. More women leaders.
Right, I do.
Right. And I wanted to ask you I wanted to address that I believe part of these this concept that women are angry, feminists are angry, have a lot to owe to a commentator in those radio stations that promote sort of conservative values,
right,
and have done a really good work reminding people over 10 years that if you are a feminist, you must be angry and therefore almost crazy, you know, and I think that there's a huge
promoting more oppression.
Right. And I have seen a backlash in this movement, which was moving towards, you know, a better understanding of who you are as a woman, as a human being. And then I think that there needs to be perhaps more awareness of how this is seen from our perspective as women of color and younger women who are also changing this dynamic. So with that, we have a few more minutes in this special program you've been listening to. This is an intergenerational, intercultural discussion.
And I have to say the part of it is because men are oppressed too.
Men are oppressed. And this is a very, very important part of our definition as feminists, of women of color. You know, the way that feminism is perceived by women, by white middle class women, mm-hmm, is quite different when you perceive it from the perspective of Latinas whose men have been oppressed for so long. The perspective of what do you see, you know, with African American women? Robinette.
What's the question?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
how is feminism, you know, what sort of face it takes when we're dealing with oppression as a group, not just of women, but mm-hmm. men who are oppressed as well.
The men, black men who are oppressed?
Who are oppressed. Or at least in this society, you know, in this, within American society,
I think
we have
everybody
Latinos.
Has been oppressed, even whites, even everybody in one way or another. Many different kind of social barriers that really, restrain humanity.
Right, but how do you go beyond? How do you go beyond that oppression?
It's just
how do you, I mean, is it
people and trying to make them aware of things?
Right. My question is whether when you, if you're oppressed as a man, do you have the right to oppress also your kids, your woman?
But they are not aware of being oppressors. I am a good man.
It's kind of acting out. Yeah, you know, they're acting out just like I did as a teenager. You know, when I was not happy in my life situation, you know, you act out and you do irrational things because you're frustrated.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I think that just listening, you know, just listening, that when there's anger, you have to find out what caused the anger.
Because
you know?
It's a sign.
There's an issue there. There's an issue there.
Yeah.
You know, and anger is, like you said, an energy.
Yeah.
Marcel, it's an energy.
Yeah, it can be used for good and for bad.
Exactly. Exactly. When I'm angry, I can really clean a good house, you know, so that's very positive. You know, you can get those tasks done when something's really troubling your mind.
Right.
So.
Well, we have about 3 minutes until the end of this program, and I wanted to pose a question to Jade, who has been here with us. And then this is about, we're seeing to a very important situation now in which there's a lot of longevity now among our women, you know, especially who exercise, who keep good care of their health. And what do you see as alternatives for women who are still alive, vibrant, and learning? So what do you see as there's more and more baby boomers and beyond?
Yeah, there is more baby boomers and beyond. And I think that life is a learning process from cradle to grave. And I think that you just have to continue to learn and to be involved in what is important in your heart, no matter what that is. You know, and I think that's the secret to longevity to me is being interested in life itself. Right. And everyone around you. You know?
Yeah, and elder, there's so much wisdom behind all these old women.
Right. You see a lot.
There's so much wisdom that you say, it's like relieving talking to an old person, like make you see things in perspective.
You know, that's where I think we have the nuclear family now, and I think that's a disadvantage to have the nuclear family, because I think the extended family really taught you about your elders. Yeah. We don't have that
value
now.
That wisdom.
Right. Right. And to be close to that wisdom.
Yeah.
You know, they've been through everything. And
they are survivors.
And then you
have everything.
But
they
also, because
everything.
Of the telling of the stories, you know, the shaping of who you are, it comes through the elder stories.
Yeah,
you are
the product
even
of
now
them.
Today.
Yeah.
That's true. And, you know, they have all the old people and all these assisted living places and everything. And I think they should be right close to their families, because I think the extended family has changed life a lot.
Right. You mentioned before that you have seen a movement of women getting together, forming coalition, you know, especially women of a certain age.
Right.
For self-dependence, interdependence. Could you tell us, we have about 1 minute before before we say goodbye. Thank you.
What did you want me to say?
A little bit of what you have seen here in Portland about this movement for coalition among women. Okay. Well,
we're wrapping it up. And, you know, I haven't seen enough coalition here yet, you know, with women getting together and being strong. I think that we need more of it. I think we need more people to come together and to talk like this and to discuss from different walks of life. And I think we need to know every aspect of our community and what they need and what they're going through.
Thank you, Jade. That was Jade Brew, senior producer here at KBOO. Robinette Jones, thank you for being with us, junior producer. We also thank Marcela Quintana O'Brien, who was here. Thank you so much to Cherie Blackfeather, producer of this special program, and our great engineer, Kate Welch, over there in the studio. This was a special program, an intergenerational, intercultural discussion hosted by Yvonne Rivero. Thanks again. This is Cable.
I was born to the labyrinth of my father's lost identity. I was raised in a place where acceptance was a dream. I scavenged for a source to define my own identity. I would call myself labels they could understand easily. But what I am, you cannot understand. My roots are deep and more vast than the word black. And my color is something you cannot behold. In your hot yellow wannabe white Oreo, I repel both sides of community denied. I walk suburban exile among stairs and store aisles. I got by in schools where ignorance is more prevalent. I was judged as less intelligent because of my skin pigment. And they looked into my eyes, checked for the conversion. They thought my knowledge would learn them out of their bigotry. And then I entered a world where they really tell you what they think. Because with a colored friend, yes, I'm automatically exempt from dealing with the racism. They created a gated community, an illusion of exclusivity to keep out undesirables. Funny to see who falls below those iron walls to become the cultural ambassador for every race in this world. Hey, you speak so well, well what did you expect? My peers were like shit because they had accents. Hey, what's your nationality? I'm American, you see, but you just want to know what makes me dark in a way that's PC. So my lessons come every day because of the color of my skin, and I'm willing to cut myself into pieces so you can a box to put me in. So when I cringe and make a face when you ask me what I am, here's a taste of one world that I live in.
Hey there, you're listening to International Women's Day on KBOO, your community radio station.